Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTDHD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm very honored to be speaking on this portion of the morning show with Colin O'Mara, who is president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. And of course, many of you surely are aware of this organization and the good work that they have done over the years on behalf of wildlife all around us in various habitats across our country. And of course, their work is even more important in this time of rapid change, in which so much about our habitats is dramatically and sometimes irreversibly altered, and often to the detriment of the well-being and safety of the animals that that are around us. And we're going to be finding out about the work that they do, and we're also going to be talking about their hopes and maybe concerns about the future as America awaits the inauguration of its newest president, Donald Trump. What is likely ahead going to be some of the issues and questions confronting us, and what will be some of the challenges maybe confronting the National Wildlife Federation as it moves forward. Colin O'Mara, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good. Thanks for having me, Greg.
Really glad to be speaking with you. Thank you for making time for this. Ahead of us talking about your organization, I would love to know a little bit about how you find yourself at the head of this important organization. And is it sort of a culmination of a lifelong interest, or is it more that you come to this as someone who's been kind of an executive of various agencies and this is just the latest? What's the story for you?
Yeah, so I grew up as a Ranger Rick kid. We published Ranger Rick magazine, and you know, some of my fondest memories are with my my grandmother and my mother. You know, when I was 4, 5, 6, 7 years old, waiting to get the magazine, doing the activities together. And I grew up in a household that was just kind of full of wildlife. And my mom's a big kind of outdoor gardener for wildlife, and you know, we spent a lot of time outdoors. And you know, I went to college in places that could give me good kind of outdoor experiences. And then I was fortunate to kind of work in different places in the kind of conservation space. And previously, before I was at the National Wildlife Federation, I was Secretary of Natural Resources and Environmental Control for the state of Delaware. So similar to George Meyer, who I'm guessing you've met at some point, who runs the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation, which is our state affiliate. He was the secretary, under Governor Thompson and others. So I had that portfolio, and I was fortunate. I was pretty young. I was 29 when I was running the agency. And I was able to do that for a little over 5 years with a great, great thoughtful governor named Jack Markell. And then a headhunter came back, said if I was interested in leading the National Wildlife Federation, and I was kind of flattered and humbled and excited. And I think one of my friends joked that my voice went about, about half an octave as I was, oh my God, this is like the National Wildlife Federation. I was a Ranger Rick kid. And then amazingly, my mom brought down banker's boxes worth of Ranger Rick magazines because she never threw out anything. From my youth, I think in an effort to kind of help me for the final interview. So it's kind of full circle in many ways. And frankly, I think the time is more important than ever that we have, strong organizations like this working on, nonpartisan, bipartisan, kind of things like wildlife should be.
Absolutely. So explain to our listeners sort of the nature of this organization. And it's, of course, one of those organizations that has one of those titles that makes it almost sound like it is a part of our government and somehow some sort of a state agency.
Yeah, so the National Wildlife Federation was created in 1936. And a year before, President Franklin Roosevelt had asked some of the top conservationists in the country, including a guy named Ding Darling, who was a big cartoonist, Thomas Beck, who was a big publisher on the East Coast, and then Aldo Leopold, kind of a favorite son of Wisconsin, to basically come up with a plan to save wildlife. And at the time, in that period, the landscape was pretty bleak. You know, the bison had been shot off the plains, the passenger pigeons had been shot out of the sky, duck populations on the East Coast were at record lows. You saw deforestation, you saw the Dust Bowl in Oklahoma. Very, very kind of concerning landscape for natural resources and for wildlife. And this group came together, and they said, look, you basically need three things. We need scientists, not politicians, making decisions. We need to have dedicated funding to do habitat restoration, and we need to educate the next generation. And Darling brought this report to President Roosevelt, and the president said, well, this is great, but how are we going to implement the second recommendation, which is money? And Darling said, well, help me invite conservationists from across the country to come to Washington, D.C., to talk about creating the kind of the political power we need to change policy. And they held this conference in February of 1936. And at the end of it, they actually decided to organize and to create the National Wildlife Federation, called the General Wildlife Federation. But, you know, Leopold was involved. I mean, all these incredible giants of that time. And the goal that Darling laid out was that we need to bring together the hunter and the angler and the sportsman community with the gardeners and the birders, with the hikers, with the 4-H clubs, with the guys that are in forestry, and basically everyone that needs and loves natural resources and wildlife needs to work together. That they might disagree around specific things, they might disagree with a lot of other political issues, but they need to mobilize together. And that's our goal. So right now we have about 6 million members across the country. We have state-level affiliates in every state, including the very strong Wisconsin Wildlife Federation, that just does amazing work in your backyard. And really the idea is to come together. And at a time when you have like a divisive election like we just had, I have as many Republicans as I do Democratic members. I got as many Tea Partiers as I do probably Green Party types. And so we really do reflect kind of the diversity of the country, whether that's politically, gender, racial demographics, sexual orientation. I mean, we really kind of reflect the full diversity of the country and basically showing that folks can still work together to get big things done.
Well, let's certainly hope so. Explain how the organization is structured, and particularly in terms of the presence that you have, in a sense, from sea to shining sea. I mean, how do you make your presence known through all 50 states?
Yeah, so it is a true federation, and so the affiliates are really the heart and soul of the organization in many ways. And so, in Wisconsin, George and his board will actually nominate directors for the national board, and they've had various folks in Wisconsin in those roles over the years. And then we have, in addition to the 50 state and territorial affiliates, we also have regional offices. So our regional office for the Great Lakes is and over in Michigan and Ann Arbor. And, we're kind of doing a lot of work in the regional level. So, kind of 50 state-level organizations, 11 regional offices, and then a big presence in D.C. But we have, between, I think we're like 350 kind of national staff, in addition to, several hundred more that are doing state-level work. And so we're in every state capital. When there's a budget cut proposed by the Walker administration, we're lending our resources to George's team to make sure that, we're defending conservation at the state level. And then when maybe there's an attack on America's public lands, George and the team in Wisconsin can, talk to Speaker Ryan or go see Senator Johnson or Senator Baldwin. So it's this great dynamism where we're all working together all the time. But, kind of wherever conservation needs a voice, we have a presence. And that's kind of the goal, kind of block by block and neighborhood by neighborhood, city by city across the entire country.
Right. So first and foremost, you are an advocacy group. And another way to think about it is you are, in a sense, a lobbying group, really trying to direct and guide and inspire our lawmakers to shape policy that will be sensitive to these particular concerns.
Yeah, so that is a big piece of what we do. We're also doing a lot of habitat restoration work on the ground, as well as a lot of education work. And so in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation has a great conservation leadership core that they attract, kind of really talented high school and college students to learn about conservation, really encourage them to go into conservation careers. And so the role may be on one day, showing up at a budget hearing to, testify on something or a piece of legislation, and the next day it might be, running a class or some kind of training for, the next generation of stewards. And so, I think one thing that makes us a little unique is a lot of folks are either advocacy groups or kind of restoration groups or education groups, and we're trying to do a little bit of all of it because we don't feel like you can really choose just one. We need activity both in politics and on the ground, as well as the next generation.
Before we look ahead, and that's of course a really important part of why we're talking today. I think it's appropriate for us to look back, since this is the 80th anniversary year of the creation of the National Wildlife Federation. How would you say the group over that period of 80 years has changed in terms of its purpose and its focus, and maybe the way in which it's gone about going after its goals? Or is it largely the same organization that it was when it was created 80 years ago, just maybe bigger and better?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I mean, anytime you have an organization of that size and that longevity, there are different kind of waves. And, I mean, a lot of the focus at the beginning of the organization was really federal. And basically, how do you mobilize state-level voices to encourage federal action? And so things like, you know, the Pittman-Robertson Act that put a small excise tax on all hunting or all, you know, kind of all ammunition as a way to fund mainly bird and mammal conservation in this country. Like a good example of, you know, state-level voices coming together to move something at the congressional level. And we did the same thing for sport fish with fishing tackle about 10 years after that, or 15 years after that. And then the big federal acts of the 60s and 70s, right? So the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, Endangered Species Act, you know, the Wilderness Act in 64. I mean, these big acts that really defined kind of conservation for the last half century. And then, you know, you begin to see the kind of nonpartisanship around environmental issues begin to fracture a little bit in the 70s. Some would argue maybe it's the role of money. Some would argue it's the role of kind of lobbying and influence by some other industry. There's political pressures as well. You also have more folks moving inside. You know, become more folks moving into cities. You see the kind of the center of power shift in some ways from more rural. You know, kind of power base in the Congress and especially the Senate towards a slightly more urbanized focus, you know, rise of, you know, bigger defense spending. I mean, there's different kind of contributors, but the community became a little fractured, and you saw some groups like the National Wildlife Federation try to figure out where they fit best. Are they more of a regulatory and like litigation type organization using those acts from the 70s to try to, the 60s and 70s to try to kind of make progress? Or are they going to be more collaborative, more kind of local based, you know, working more with like private landowners and, you know, individual groups kind of outside of government. And so we kind of went back and forth a little bit between those worlds. And I think I'm trying to get us to a place where, you know, we're just as comfortable working with Republican legislators as Democratic legislators and really trying to take the politics out of this. So that, yes, there are places where regulations are necessary, but a lot of times if you do collaborative work up front, maybe they're not as necessary. And so really not being affiliated with either party, I think a lot of times folks kind of take sides. And I have a buddy of mine that says, you know, there's no such thing as a Republican white-tailed deer or a Democratic smallmouth bass. Like, you know, this stuff can't be partisan. And so you can't just align with the Democrats or just align with the Republicans. We've got to be working with everybody to really make sure we're making meaningful progress. So right now, I mean, I would argue one of the most bipartisan kind of phases in the national wildlife history, probably more so than any time since the 70s.
We're speaking with Colin O'Mara, who is president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. There are several tenets that are central to what you do, and I just want to explore a couple of the most important and find out a little bit more about the specifics. Right at the top of the list is the protection of wildlife. It's obviously central to your mission. It's central to your name, for that matter. What are sort of the most important hallmarks of what guides you in terms of this particular purpose? I mean, is it safeguarding every single species of every kind of wildlife, or are there certain species that merit special protection? I mean, how do you focus your efforts in something that is as enormous a challenge as this?
No, absolutely. It's a great question. And, you know, I mean, our mission, you know, kind of specifically is uniting all Americans, because, you know, we want folks from all stripes, all walks of life, all backgrounds, you know, to ensure wildlife thrive in our rapidly changing world, right? I mean, we're losing habitat at an alarming rate. You got climate impacts, you have invasive species, you have new diseases we're trying to manage. I mean, there's a lot of challenges on the landscape. you know, unlike a lot of other groups that maybe focus on a single species or two, you know, we do focus on kind of the full diversity of wildlife. And, you know, one of the things we've learned over the last century is that when we fund conservation efforts, species do incredibly well. You know, at the turn of the century, when I was talking about some of those big acts in the 1930s, you know, at the beginning of the last century, you know, white-tailed deer populations were less than 500,000 in America. We're over 20 million today. Like, you can't find a suburban, you know, kind of family that hasn't had their, you know, their hostas, you know, eaten out by a white-tailed deer. I mean, a huge recovery success. You know, wild turkeys, very, very rare 50 years ago, extremely plentiful now. And so, you know, the things that we've kind of focused on, even bald eagles, right, that was more of a regulatory approach, but, you know, you reduce DDT and you reduce some other kind of drivers that were causing a lot of mortality, and all of a sudden the populations come back. And one of the biggest things I'm focused on right now is that we have a whole range of species that are things that we don't hunt and fish that are in trouble. And this is everything from tiny monarch butterflies that have decreased in population by over 90% in the last 15 years, and pollinators like bees, like native bees and honeybees, to bigger species like moose, where we're seeing the moose populations crater in a whole bunch of places in the Great Lakes and in New England. And so, the drivers are different, but they all come back to, I would argue, kind of a lack of kind of collective effort to making sure that we're restoring habitat, providing sufficient habitat. And I'll just give you one example. You know, we're clearing a ton of habitat in the Great Plains right now. We've lost more than 10 million acres since 2007 of native grasslands and wetlands and forests in the kind of in the westward part of the Great Lakes through the Dakotas and into Nebraska and Iowa. And most of it's because we're putting a huge amount of cropland into production to create corn ethanol. And it's a tough topic, right? I mean, folks want different kinds of fuels. At the time, they wanted less focus on foreign oil. But the implications of that is that we've lost, you know, 5 to 10 million acres of habitat for things that would have helped pollinators and pheasants and ducks and swift foxes and meadowlarks. And so I think one of the things that we're focused on right now is how can wildlife have a place in our world with all these other challenges? How do we make that more of a priority that unites people too? Because no one at the end of the day wants to have, you know, monarchs go extinct on our watch. But at the same time, we got to be more thoughtful about what we're doing on the landscape to make sure these species can thrive.
Right. Is there any good news or any progress to which you can draw our attention? Or at the moment, are these grim numbers still a reality that, in a sense, have not been turned around?
I mean, there's about 8,000 species that I'm concerned about right now across the U.S., and about 1,500 of those are candidates for listing under the Endangered Species Act in the next couple of years. But there's some huge successes. And, you know, the bighorn sheep populations out west, we were less than 5,000 or 10,000 a few years ago. We're well over 80,000 now. I'm excited about some of the progress with the grizzly bear populations have recovered in just amazing numbers in the Yellowstone region of western Wyoming and eastern Montana. We've seen, you know, really strong recovery of you know, wolf populations in a bunch of different places. And obviously that's a contentious issue, but there's they're doing really well. I mean, I'm excited about some of the recent numbers around individual kind of fish where we kind of remove some dams and kind of increase passage. So there's a lot of bright spots. And so, like, we know we can succeed. Usually the success is limited by kind of collaboration and by resources more than anything. But no, there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic.
Mm.
And I think, frankly, making sure that, you know, we're showing how this improves people's quality of life, because, like, you know, we'll talk about the election later, but, you know, I mean, when folks are concerned about their economic livelihood and their ability to put food on the table, now some of these other issues seem, you know, little secondary. You know, and one of the things that we often point out is that, you know, the outdoor industry is about a $646 billion industry. It employs more than 6 million folks. It's a $7 billion industry just in Wisconsin. And so if we protect these resources, we can actually create more jobs. We can actually create, you know, better experiences and actually generate more wealth as a way to strengthen the economy. So, you know, I mean, think that's how we're kind of, you know, those are kind of the bright lights that I think of. It's like when we do this well, we are, there's nowhere better in the world over the last 100 years than the U.S. at doing species. There's even more that we need to do, though.
Hmm. And of course, you've already touched on the fact that when it comes to protecting these various species, so much comes back to restoration of habitat, which is a complicated matter, of course, because in many cases you are talking about land that belongs to somebody, or land that is ripe for development in one way or another. Just say a word about just how steep a challenge this is to safeguard habitat and guard it from use that might be really, really counterproductive for wildlife protection.
Yeah, the model before, over the past 100 years, even going back to when President Theodore Roosevelt was president, was this idea that, the best way to protect things was basically to put it into some kind of government ownership, and that, you buy land that's important habitat. This is how a lot of the refuges were created, like the Melhor Refuge, for example, where there was that shameful, I would argue, armed standoff with the vigilantes that took over the facility there. That was protected because there was an important kind of stopover for a bunch of different migratory birds. And so this idea of kind of place-based, kind of small, targeted conservation. What we've learned over the last, 20 or 30 years in particular is that we need to be talking about landscapes. We need to be talking about migration corridors. And so that means maybe it's less important to have, every single, parcel be public, but how do we make sure we work with private landowners in a very collaborative way, using incentives, using different kind of partnership models to try to make sure that, as they're taking on other activities on their land, and maximizing the economic value, that they're also contributing to these habitat corridors. And we've seen some great successes. I mean, we've worked with, some strange bedfellows, like working with the oil and gas industry, to try to make sure that as they're changing kind of techniques and becoming a little more surgical in the way they conduct some of their work, that they're making sure there's good habitat for a mule deer or pronghorn or sage grouse or, these different species. Trying to be more intelligent about siting. Like, if you have a parcel, and actually Wisconsin's actually been a national leader in this for 20 or 30 years, the Nature Conservancy and groups like Wisconsin Wildlife Federation, working with developers saying, hey, if you put, more units on this part of the parcel and then maybe conserve this other part, that's a better thing for wildlife. I mean, having those kind of conversations. But it's slow because it's really parcel by parcel, right? It's project by project. And I think where the national where I'm trying to take the national conversation, saying, like, we have to engage in those conversations as partners, as neighbors, as, collaborators, rather than trying to have government dictate who can do what where. Because, frankly, when we do it that way, we wind up in a lot of litigation, a lot of contention, and wildlife often loses because the uncertainty doesn't actually – during that paralysis period, nothing good for wildlife is happening. Mm. And I think that's where we're trying to kind of shift the conversation a little bit.
I was a little bit taken aback, although I suppose I shouldn't have been, not at all. But as I was reading about the work that your organization does with protection of habitat, right at the top of the list is waters. And of course, it absolutely stands to reason. If there's no way that you can do the work that you do without being concerned about the well-being of our water, and in particular the undergirding of the Clean Water Act, and of course water is a primary issue right here in the state of Wisconsin, as it is in other places. What would you say are the most significant points of focus for the National Wildlife Federation when it comes to protection of our waters?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest issue right now is water has to be a bigger national priority. Right, whether you're the poor folks in Toledo that had the algal bloom a couple of years ago that knocked out the water supply for 3 days, or the folks in Flint that have been drinking kind of lead infested water for almost going on 2 years now, to some counties in Wisconsin that don't have sufficient water supplies and are trying to figure out how to meet their community needs. You have these problems all across the country with the droughts, and there's a massive drought in the southeast that hasn't gotten nearly enough media coverage. It's not quite at the California level, but for them, it's a record level in Alabama and Georgia right now. And so you got these drought issues on the quantity side, as well as the quality issues that we're seeing pop up in the Rust Belt. And my hometown of Syracuse, New York, has had some challenges, with contamination from the past. That the industries are long gone, but the contamination continues to affect communities. And then you layer on top of it what we're going to see from more extreme storms and flooding and sea level rise. I mean, 30 years from now, when folks look back and judge us, the first question I think they're going to ask is, how do they engage on these climate and water issues? And I think one of the things that we try to do often it's hold up the Great Lakes as a model. There's a coalition that we help lead called the Healing Our Waters Coalition that has brought together, you know, hundreds of groups across Wisconsin and Michigan and Illinois and the other Great Lakes states to try to make sure there's a unified, bipartisan, nonpartisan, you know, voice in Washington to try to make sure that it's invested in. A thing that I often say makes the Great Lakes so special is that it's not a partisan issue in your neck of the woods, right? I mean, it's a value. You know, everyone loves the Great Lakes. You know, everyone loves their individual tributaries that are feeding into them. And I think if we could replicate that love of water that I think, you know, folks in Wisconsin demonstrate so well in other parts of the country, we'd be in a much better place.
Hmm. I also want to take a moment to ask you about another component of your group's work with Habitat, and that is when you reach out to tribal nations across the country. What are some of the sort of special issues involved there, or what would be some of the concerns unique to various sovereign tribal nations across the country? I mean, I guess another way to ask is, why are they in need of, in a sense, maybe special help from your group?
Yeah, the I love working with our tribal partners. And I mean, given the historical connection between some of these tribes and natural resources, and right now tribes manage more than almost 100 million acres of important wildlife habitat across the country. And obviously, there's, you know, some shameful parts of that past in terms of the U.S. government involvement and kind of moving folks onto some of these reservations. But there's incredibly important wildlife. And I had a chance. Just kind of a quick story. I was in Wyoming a couple weeks ago. Our team has been working and really trying to support the Eastern Shoshone tribes on the Wind River Reservation for years, trying to help them get bison back on their plains. The last bison were kind of shot off the plains 130 years ago, and they've been working ever since trying to get bison back on. And one of the things that I think a lot of us, you know, that I study wildlife, one of the most shameful parts of American history is the way that there was kind of a systematic removal of bison from the landscape. I mean, some of it was hunting, some of it was food. A lot of it was intentionally taking bison off the landscape because it was a way to control the Native American populations, many of whom were somewhat nomadic, kind of following the herds for sustenance. And there's a way, if they broke that connection, that symbiotic relationship with bison, it was a way to you know, kind of force increase, kind of accelerate the march towards the reservations. Just very, very shameful stuff. And there's very explicit, you know, kind of directions on some of these. And so one of the things we're working on is helping them restore these bison herds. And it's cultural, it's economic. There's big tourism opportunities, and there's also, you know, kind of for sustenance and nutrition. And so we were able to kind of do that with Shoshone. We're working with several tribes in Montana as well. But one of their goals is to try to, you know, help them recreate the ecosystem that they were stewards of for so many generations as a way to help bring some additional economic vitality into their communities. There's also issues with water rights. The tribes have a lot of water rights through their various treaties. A lot of them have been either neglected or kind of not fulfilled by various government entities. But, you know, the time I get to spend with the tribes, some of the most rewarding work that we do. And so between water and wildlife issues, there's just so many areas of commonality. I have the director of the Navajo Nation's Fish and Wildlife Programs on my board. You know, just we just have wonderful relationships that we hope to do a lot more with in the years ahead, because it's just, they're kindred spirits in every way.
Hmm. One of the really interesting hallmarks of the work that the National Wildlife Federation is doing is in confronting climate change. And of course, this is a case in which we begin to step into maybe trickier territory. That is, I think, you know, as you said before, I think just about everybody hopes we will always have beautiful monarch butterflies and whatever else in terms of specific protection of wildlife, and we all want beautiful places that we can visit and enjoy. When it comes to the matter of climate change, of course, now we're talking about something in which there is at least a bit of difference of opinion, even if the scientific community seems fairly united around the notion that we are changing our planet's climate in some very dangerous, detrimental ways. First of all, how long has the issue of climate change been a part of the National Wildlife Federation's work?
Yeah, I mean, our lead wildlife biologist, who just retired a little bit ago, was working on this issue 30 years ago.
Wow!
Within the scientific community, as they were beginning, as the kind of leading thinkers of the time were beginning to try to figure out, you know, kind of the dynamics and the kind of the role of human contributions versus other types of contributions, and looking at this issue. I think you framed the question perfectly, which is that there is a scientific consensus. What there isn't is a political consensus about what to do with it. And I think, you know, obviously, you know, there are some things that, you know, weren't particularly science-based said during the campaign about, you know, it being a hoax or, you know, kind of perpetrated by the Chinese. I'm hoping over the next few years we can get to a place where we can have a meaningful conversation about what's the best way to tackle the problem. You know, there's a regulatory approach that the Obama White House took. It was kind of the only tool that they had at their disposal because there wasn't any kind of pathway for bipartisan congressional action. But it's not the most effective way to address these challenges. You know, I think that, you know, I understand the frustration of someone who grew up in upstate New York of, you know, the impact of, you know, some regulations on some industries. And I think, you know, no one can argue that the air is not cleaner and the water is not cleaner because of the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. But, you know, we have to be smart about, you know, when regulations are needed and what the best tools are. And I think, you know, one of the things that, you know, as someone that did grow up in, you know, kind of the Rust Belt in a very blue collar area, I think if as we talk about this problem, we've made it so academic that it's not accessible to the average person. And I think, you know, when you talk about it in terms of, you know, that trout stream that's hotter than it was, warmer than it was before, so the spawning rates are screwed up. Or you talk about, you know, the pine bark beetles that are affecting forests that are then, you know, killing the trees and leading to forest fires. Or you talk about the storms that we're seeing in the East Coast or the drought that we're seeing in the Southwest. I mean, that's a way to localize this. I mean, the original talking points around climate were so focused on, you know, polar bears and puffins and the Maldives going underwater and these places that I think the average American might be able to maybe conceptualize in their head, but the closest that you know, I've ever been to a polar bear is in a zoo, right? I mean, I've spent some time in Alaska. I've never been in kind of northern part of Alaska, and I've had a chance to travel more than most folks. But this is affecting people's daily lives. Now we're in the hottest year ever, which is hotter than last year, which was previously the hottest year ever. If we don't get serious about this, it's going to be a problem. But we have to do it in a way that takes into account how it affects regular folks in a way that I think has been a little missing from some of the national conversation.
As you at the National Wildlife Federation talk about this issue and talk about strategies and where your focus in these efforts needs to be, is there even within your organization some difference of opinion? I don't mean in terms of climate change being real. I suspect that that within an organization like yourself, that probably is not even a point of discussion anymore, but what do we do? What is of most concern? What do we go after first? What can be done about this? I mean, is there room for disagreement around questions like that?
No, absolutely. And this is one thing I love about the Federation. You know, we have an annual meeting every year where all 50 affiliates come together and they debate resolutions. And they'll debate, you know, what's the best solution to a different problem. And they've jumped into, you know, endangered species issues or water issues or climate issues. And they wrestle it out, right? They talk, you know, somebody will say, hey, I think the solution should be this approach. Somebody else says, maybe I think it should be that. And they actually have these great dialogues, which frankly, the way I'd like to see, you know, more federal policy, you know, kind of occur where there's actual debate and actual, you know, I mean, it's not quite kind of the full, you know, kind of Greek democracy of the, you know, the folks in the ecclesia and kind of debating out every element, but there is this rigorous kind of conversations, resolutions that are debated and massaged and trying to come to some kind of consensus or at least an informed consent. There's a lot of disagreements. I mean, I think there's in the realm of clean energy, right? I mean, like, we want to see clean energy, but we also want to see clean energy sited well. You know, I don't want to see wind turbines in the middle of important flyways that, you know, would affect bird populations. I want to make sure, you know, solar is sited in a way that we're not just, you know, losing a bunch of important habitat on the ground. I'm very bullish on a technology called offshore wind in the Atlantic Ocean environment, because it can go 10 to 12 miles offshore, and there's very few seabirds that are out that far. Gannets and maybe a couple other species. And if you get the sighting right, the timing of the construction cycle, you can avoid the migration of the right whale and some sea turtles. And so I think one thing we try to say is we can have both. What we don't want to do is just move from a entirely fossil fuel based system to a completely technology driven clean energy system while still not addressing the underlying natural resource issues. We think we can actually improve wildlife health and restore a lot of natural resources as a way to address the climate challenges. If we restore forests, right, if we reduce forest fires, we clean up forests, we reduce, increase wetland health, those also have carbon benefits. And so we want to see a more balanced natural solution. But there's a lot of debate. I think that's what this country needs. We've made it a dichotomous choice. Do you believe in climate science? It's not Santa Claus. The science is kind of the science. I think the question is, what do you do with it, right? And what makes the most sense for local communities? And we might end up with very different answers across the country. What makes sense for Wisconsin might be very different than Nevada or very different than Massachusetts. And I'm hoping we have that conversation, because that's a great conversation for the American federal form of government.
I was a bit taken aback on your website when there's discussion about this issue, when it is said climate change, I'm quoting the website now, is the greatest existing threat to American wildlife, wild places and communities around the country. I was a little bit surprised, because I can think of all kinds of other things that seem like very, very potent and immediate threats. And maybe the problem is that they are more, in a sense, visible threats. I mean, you can see when that used to be a park, but now it's a Burger King with a parking lot.
Right.
And so, I mean, with that the effect that potentially has is pretty clear. And the effect that something like climate change has on the well-being of our wildlife is not as easy to see. Can you just sketch why the connection is so powerful that you would state it in such a way that this is the greatest threat?
Yeah, and the Joni Mitchell song in my head, right? They paved over paradise, that's obviously the kind of the visual. The challenge with climate is that it is affecting everything, right? So we're seeing impacts on water resources, right, in terms of droughts or some saltwater intrusion on the East Coast, which is changing the salinity of things like Galveston Bay, which is then affecting 200 different species in that part of southeastern Texas, or the drought out west in California that's affecting several different aquatic species in the Sacramento Delta through the Central Valley. It's the connection to the impact on habitat. We're also seeing some vectors of disease as we're seeing more and more of these disease kind of spread in new ways, and that again is accelerated by climate. And so maybe we need to word it better if you kind of read it back to me, but it's not saying that it's just kind of the carbon emissions and the temperature. It's that what happens as a result of that in affecting several other existing stressors and basically accelerating them. Right? Because if you use a forest as an example, you have beautiful national and state forests in Wisconsin, and you've been fortunate not to have quite the same level of fires, but you've had a few.
Yes.
But you look out west right now, these massive forest fires that are happening, and again, it's not entirely climate-induced. There's a lot of other issues going on. You have soil health issues. You have a lack of management. You have a lot of dead trees that aren't getting taken out. You've had a lack of kind of investment and kind of riparian restoration and waterway health. But when we're seeing fires that are burning hotter, bigger, and longer than ever before, and the impact on the wildlife that are in those habitats, some burning is good, right? I mean, we do prescribe burns. You want some natural burning, but we've never seen anything like this.
Right. Well, and of course,
again,
and I was so
a contributor.
Yeah, and I was so alarmed to see the recent headlines in the last couple of days about massive fires down south. I mean, a region of the country where we don't even think about a significant prairie fires and forest fires. That's really scary when we start to think about this beginning to enter other parts of the country.
That's exactly right. And I had a friend that was a mayor of a big city on the East Coast, and he said, I knew we were in trouble when a murder no longer made the front page. And the thing that worries me now is that, like, a big fire like that you're talking about, like, was not huge national news. It's a big deal. I mean, yes, I get that the transition is exciting and there's a million things going on with the president-elect and, you know, everything else. But there are some big things happening right now related to, you know, storms and fires and things like that that are increasingly underreported because they're becoming commonplace.
Mm.
And right, and so, and folks are—they're almost like desensitized to it, right? But and this is what the worrisome part is, because if you don't have—if you—and again, I don't want to scare people. I want to make sure it's all based on science, because I do think there are some folks that are kind of like shock jocks on this stuff. Not everything is climate related, but when you're seeing, you know, every model predicting more frequent, you know, kind of more intense activities, and then you're also seeing those activities on the landscape, you know, we need to take action.
Right, we need to wake up. I was glad to see that Ranger Rick magazine is still in existence. And, of course, this takes us back to how you first got so interested in all of these different issues. And it looks like the National Wildlife Federation takes this particular mission very, very seriously of reaching out to young people across the country.
No, absolutely. I mean, right now, the average kid spending between 30 and 50 hours a week in front of some kind of screen, you know, the connection to nature is being lost very, very quickly as more and more folks move into cities. And so we've been kind of doubling down on Ranger Rick and really trying to get more kids outdoors. We're in about 11,000 schools across the country. I'd love that to be, you know, three times that. I'd love to be in, you know, many more schools in Wisconsin and other parts of the country, because I think this connection is so important. And the thing that's, you know, I guess fantastic right now is that there's more and more studies coming out showing if we can get kids into nature, not only does it improve their health and their, you know, kind of connection, their love of the natural resources themselves, but also improves their ability to do science, technology, engineering, and math. It increases their confidence, their leadership development. They're forced to actually interact with other kids, which is good for a whole bunch of development purposes instead of, you know, just playing with their thumbs on some kind of gadget. So we're going to keep making a big push. Again, completely nonpartisan issue. There's no reason why that, you know, and frankly, I mean, I actually get a lot, in some cases, I get more support from Republicans on this issue than some of the Democrats that are more urban and maybe don't see it as connected to their day-to-day kind of constituent lives, where I'd argue it's as important there as anywhere. Sean Duffy, your great congressman, has been in Wisconsin, has been a, you know, great supporter of getting more kids outdoors, and obviously he's a big active outdoors guy himself. So, you know, we're, and then actually the speaker, I mean, Speaker Ryan's been, you know, supportive of these efforts too. I mean, he's a guy that goes out and hunts and, you know, fishes and everything too. So again, we're hoping there, you know, maybe with some more leadership, you know, coming out of replicating some good stuff going on in Wisconsin, we can, you know, make this a little bit of a, again, a nonpartisan, you know, priority.
Right, and move the needle in a positive direction. You're obviously swimming upstream against a lot of other cultural forces, but this is obviously worth the effort. I think just about everybody would agree on that. So we have a new president elect, of course, and the National Wildlife Federation reacted fairly quickly with, I guess, what would be a kind of a public statement or even sort of an open letter in which you appear to be guardedly optimistic or hopeful, or I'm not sure what the word is. I'm not sure I would say quite confident. There are reasons, of course, for your organization to maybe have some misgivings about what the future holds. What is your sense of what is ahead is in terms of some of these issues under a Donald Trump presidency?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of opportunities for collaboration on natural resource issues. One thing that we worked with the campaign, we worked with both campaigns during, we're, you know, nonpartisan like that, but we encouraged them to talk, you know, about, you know, protecting America's public lands, and keeping them in public hands, and, you know, trying to improve their management, increasing access, creating opportunities for hunting and fishing and birding and other, you know, other outdoor activities. And Mr. Trump, during the campaign, had a paragraph in his stump speech when, you know, when he was in Wisconsin or when he was in Michigan or in Colorado or in, you know, Arizona. And he would talk about the importance of conservation, and he would, you know, and he'd always use these kind of broader statements, but, you know, things like, you know, we're going to conserve your lands, we're going to increase, you know, opportunities for hunting and fishing, we're going to increase wildlife, we're going to defend individual rights. I mean, and so there was, we're hoping that we're able to, because I do think that there's an argument that at least in some parts of the country, sportsmen did, you know, maybe put them over the top a little bit. There may be some opportunities there. At the same time, some of the things you said about the Environmental Protection Agency, which is extremely important to protecting the air and water and and natural resources that wildlife depend upon were, you know, little very concerning. If everything from abolishing the agency to, you know, kind of undoing, you know, basic regulations that protect our public health and our wildlife health. So I think our goal is, you know, trying to find where there's places we can work together, do that, because I think, you know, I had an old mentor that used to say, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. And so I want to make sure we're the conservation voice is at the table. And then there's other places where we'll hopefully kind of convince him over time as he's kind of going from the poetry of, I'm not sure we can call it poetry in this campaign, but the rhetoric of a campaign into the actual prose of governing. So again, it's good. There's going to be challenges, and I don't want to sugarcoat it. I mean, you know, there's some, you know, there's a lot of industry folks around him and others, but I don't think we can take the next 4 years off. And there's a lot of groups across the country that want to stand in and fight on everything, and I respect that. But the rate of change we're seeing, at least from a wildlife and a climate perspective, we can't have 4 years of just playing defense. We need to make progress where we can, and then, you know, have rational, thoughtful, you know, disagreement where, and hopefully kind of progress where we don't agree right now.
Right. And of course, you can at least turn to the fact that you have been a nonpartisan organization and have worked to build bridges on both sides of the political aisle. So that puts you probably in a stronger position politically than maybe some other advocacy organizations that that are maybe much more aligned with one side or the other. I mean, it sounds like the organization has taken great pains to avoid that intense politicization, and maybe that bodes well for what might still be possible.
Exactly. And our big goal is to try to have both parties come to kind of where what our priorities and our positions are, as opposed to us chasing the candidates. And so in this campaign cycle, we put out two pledges in kind of your part of the country. One was related to public lands, asking that the candidates both commit to keeping public lands public and not selling them to private industry, which should be a no-brainer, but this kind of flares up every few years. And at the same time, improving their management, improving their access. And both campaigns agreed. Mr. Trump put it into his stump speech. Secretary Clinton sent a very eloquent letter. And so they both agreed to that. We also asked both campaigns to commit to continuing funding for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. And both campaigns did. And so I think that's a good example of how we're trying to work with both sides to make conservation priorities nonpartisan, bringing both sides together, as opposed to saying, you know, this candidate's horrible on this thing or this candidate's great on this thing, and then, you know, kind of burning a bridge that you may need to cross later.
Well put. So if people listening are interested in knowing more about the National Wildlife Federation, perhaps even supporting you in some way, what should they do?
Yeah, we'd love to have them visit the website. It's www.nwf.org for National Wildlife Federation, nwf.org. They can also, you know, Google Ranger Rick if they want to update their subscription for their kids or grandkids. You know, it's a wonderful publication, and we actually just launched a new publication for 0 to 3-year-olds. And then we have the Ranger Rick Jr. and Ranger Rick for the slightly older kids. And then we're on, you know, Facebook and Twitter, and just type in the National Wildlife. If you type in the National Wildlife Federation at Google, you'll find more than you ever wanted to know about us. So we'd love to have your help. And also I encourage folks to look up the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation. They're a fabulous organization doing great work right in your home state. And they're a federation of a lot of the individual hunting and fishing and birding groups across the state of Wisconsin. And I think George calls it Wisconservation, as the goal there. So they're part of the federation as well. So lots of ways to get involved.
Very good. Colin O'Mara, thank you so much for all the good work that you've done, and I appreciate you being so generous with your time. It was wonderful to talk with you today. Best wishes to you and to all the good people at the National Wildlife Federation.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, an interview with Stephen Wong, the co-author of a wonderful book for baseball fans called Game Worn: Baseball Treasures from the Game's Greatest Heroes and Moments. It's one of those gorgeous coffee table books, and mostly it captures images of some of the most treasurable jerseys worn by some of the game's most important players. It's an absolutely wonderful book, and you'll hear our conversation tomorrow. There's no morning show on Thursday or Friday because of the Thanksgiving holiday. On Monday, Brian Albrecht, president of Gateway Technical College, pays his monthly visit to the program, joined by two members of the Board of Trustees. On Tuesday, we'll preview the Carthage Christmas Festival by talking with Dr. Peter Dene, who coordinates the festival, and out of the archives, an interview from 10 years ago with longtime Carthage College organist Bill Roth, talking about how the beautiful Fritsch Memorial Pipe Organ in Siebert Chapel was designed and constructed. The organ is now 40 years old.